we have done up to now, these non-underlined epitomes up to the point of the third part, Christianity, at the point of truth. And now we come to the point of love, which covers that whole Last Supper preaching, that part which is one of the biggest sermon that has ever been preached, I would say. In that one, from the point of view of love, we see that error has no more to be handled with. It had to be handled, it was handled from the point of view of truth. So now the field is free, everything is at the point of reality and only reality, so that we can see here the epitome reads, we reach now through love the oneness of the infinite one, so that we get that sense that we only can reach really the oneness in being if we have handled before that, from the point of view of truth, the belief in animal magnetism, the belief in sin, sickness, and death, and the belief in a people universe. Without that, we cannot never reach really the oneness of being, or else it is just the human effort that we make, and the human effort is not the Christ idea. So what do we see is necessary as four subtones that are shown here in order that we can really experience that oneness of the Infinite One. From the point of view of the Word, you have the very first thing that we must see, the oneness of Word, Christ, and Christianity. It is a terrific sense here to show that everyone individually is one with the whole. That's what is presented here, that each individual in this Father's house are many mentions. Everybody has an individual identity, but that everyone is one with the Father, is one with the Word, that everyone is one with the Christ, with the one Christ, and that everyone is one with Christianity, with the whole realm of spiritual ideas, and therefore sum it up as to be the oneness of being. So this is the starting point, the Word. The Word is always the starting point. It is always the statement of what the subject is all about. So going out just from that statement where we see that everything is one, we have to see further as a second step, namely that we must abide in this oneness. Abiding is always to keeping the unity. It's always that Emmanuel, God with us, that we keep that unity with God intact. And so that whole passage is full of renderings about adhering and claiming, so that we do not let loose of something, that we adhere to it, and that we stick to that oneness with that Word and Christ and Christianity. Again, we see that the oneness in being is not just a nice atmosphere, but that the Christ comes in and says, you have to do something about it, you have to stick with it. You can't let it go. It is necessary that you abide with it, and abide with it, and abide with it. There are about 9 different renderings there that show this sticking to it, this abiding to it, this remaining in it, so that one feels that is our contribution to that oneness. Then we can go further and come to the next one, where to Christianity. Once we have abided with that oneness with the Word, Christ, and Christianity, that then really we have seen that we have overcome the world. Then we abide no more with something else than the fourfold calculus. And so we have overcome the world. The world is the material calculus, the material way of thinking. So to overcome the world, which is always a desire of each one of us and says, well, I would like to overcome the world. The world is not always so nice as it seems to be. How can I overcome the world? It shows that we cannot start by trying to overcome the world. We have to have the prepositions of the word of Christ, which says, well, first you have to see what it means that you are individually one with the Father, that you are individually one with the Christ, with the Son, then you are individually one with all, and only then, really, if you abide in that oneness as the Christ, if you abide with it and abide with it and stick to it and remain within it, then only then have you overcome the world. Then you have laid down really the material sense of the world and you are one with the spiritual realm of reality. So that we have love and mind in its purest sense there as an experience really that the world has no more anything in us. The prince of the world says, she says then, cometh and findeth nothing in us. So that we see that we need an ordered development within ourselves in order to arrive at that point. Then when we have overcome that world, we could say, well, is there anything more that is necessary? This is certainly a climax, and why is anything more necessary? Why should I have even a further step to do in my understanding? And then John gives us the last vertical of science, namely where he shows that the true knowledge of the one glory is necessary. The knowledge, you can see at once, it's a science that enters in that text and is full of knowing, and you should know, and the knowledge, so that we see there is more to be accomplished than just to overcome the world, but that is only an outcome in the on the human level, but that actually the purpose of this Christianity is higher and is more than just overcome the world. And that is usually unknown. We think, well, that is the purpose, to overcome the world. But John has a different idea about that. He says, no, that's only one step on the way and to the aim. And what is the aim? The aim is to know really the glory of God. And it's one of the most wonderful chapters there where he depicts what the knowledge of the glory of God is. And he goes right through the system of Christian Science, right through the model of Christian Science. We see there a first hint of what the model of being is. But at this point, we are not going to go into it. We leave that for a further unfoldment, so that we just at this moment are aware that we must have a further view and a further aim than just to overcome the world. That is not the end of all. But at the end of all is that we have a scientific consciousness, a scientific understanding of the world of God himself, of the science of God itself, that really is our great aim. There he will show that we must understand really the four levels of science, we must understand the fourfold calculus, how it translates itself, the fourfold calculus, how we can demonstrate it, furthermore that we must know how the divine principle operates as a fourfold calculus. That's just a quick review. We will go back to it later on in this week to look at it closer so as to elaborate on that idea. All right. Let's just flow through it again just to listen to these four different angles of the oneness of the Infinite One. So that the oneness of the Infinite One is not just a mystical oneness, but that it is a scientific oneness. And what is this scientific oneness? Again, we go out, let's see, from the word, which first says, I must first make the real statement. The word is always the real statement, the real proposition for the subject. So it goes out and says, oneness means that you are one with all four factors in being. One with the Father, the Word, one with the Son, the Christ, one with all Christianity, and one with the divine principle. If you see that oneness, then you can go further and say, now, is that enough to see that? And the Christ comes, the second epitome comes in and says, you have to stick to that. You have to stick to that. You have to abide by this oneness. So we have to contribute something to this oneness and not just say, well, this oneness is something that is that exists in reality, which does exist in reality, but we don't make it our own if we are not in agreement with that reality and stick to that reality. So always the Christ is that unity, that spiritual agreement between God and man, or the spiritual agreement between man and God, whatever line we will take, and therefore see that we have to watch our thoughts, that we do not lose that oneness constantly, that we are not sidetracked constantly by losing that oneness. So if we stick to that oneness, then we are no more one with anything that is opposed to the one being. Therefore, that is a consciousness which has overcome, we come to Christianity, the world. That overcomes the world, and we have overcome the world, John says. So we see the overcoming of the world is actually the outcome. All this Christianity is the outcome of the Christ idea, is the outcome of that abiding in the Christ, and the abiding in the Christ is set out in the world as abiding within the Father. So having a statement what the Father is, what the oneness with God is, and abiding in it, we have overcome the world. But though having overcome the world is not the end of it, it says, but after all, the one infinite must be seen. The infinite one, not only the oneness of being, when I speak about oneness of being, then being is written with a lowercase, with a small b, not with a capital B, but science then comes and says, you have to see that oneness in the one being, capital B, that the one being has within itself a whole science, that the one being is not just an empty shell, or is not just a nirvana consciousness, is not just an undefined and unidentified oneness, but it is a oneness that contains within itself the whole science of being, capital B, the whole science of being. So we learn there then really the glory of the science of being, capital B. That is Christianity at its culmination point. Yeah? Okay. Let's say we have got that rhythm, and so we can go further and come to the fourth part. The fourth part of omni-action of principle, where we just have the middle shaft of the candlestick as principle, and have principle as omni-action, so that we can say nothing is ever going on at that point, but principle operating as principle's own idea. That principle would not be a principle, would not be recognizable as a principle, if it would not have its own idea. So that from the infinite one, as Mrs. Eddy says, comes one principle, but with that principle comes the infinite idea. So that principle without an idea is just non-existent. It must have an idea in order to prove itself to be a principle, in order to show itself that it is a principle, that it operates as a principle, that it is self-operative, self-active, omni-active as a principle, so that it is independent of any other, or independent of people, or independent of any other factors. It's self-contained within itself, that principle. Doesn't need anything outside, no outside aid, no outside information, nothing like that. Principle knows itself as principle. And knowing itself infinitely as principle means that it knows itself as infinite ideas of principle. And this is what is shown here from the two standpoints of truth and love. We take first the one from truth in order to show how truth is active here. So truth first wants to say this omni-action of principle is of the nature of truthfulness, therefore it knows no error. When it operates without making an error. That never something is fallible in that principle, because it's truth. So nothing fails within that operation of that truth. That principle as divine power never fails. So that truth here is showing that it cannot be overpowered, that truth is the truth and cannot be sidetracked in any way, cannot be licked in any way, that truth sees that the principle is always operating as its own principle. Or perhaps we can say that truth is always at the helm of everything, is always the commander of a situation, that it is has always dominion of every situation, that it is an infallible dominion, an infallible authority, because, and this is actually the nature of truth, because the human mind encounters many situations where it feels that principle is not operating, that principle is not only letting truth operate, but it lets also error operate, and that is typical, really, in that life story of Jesus. We remember it's that life story which begins at the point after the Last Supper, where Jesus said, "Now let's get up and go." Well, why should John write such a ordinary point where it says, "Now let's get up from the Last Supper and let's go"? Well, this seems to be so superfluous to say that is, and yet it is so important to see it, because under the term "let's go," he always wanted to show, let's go the way, that is the way of life. So from that point on, we see Jesus really getting up and go the way of life, no, and not to let himself be sidetracked by anything that happens on that way. That he goes right through the situation and doesn't try to get around the situation, but that he goes right through it. And though he knew what would happen, he knew that he would be caught by the soldiers, that he would be bound by them. So it was night. He knew it was night. So the human sense of it would say, well, this is too bad a situation. I get out of it. By night, I can disappear very quickly. Even by light, Jesus could appear very quickly, and he could have sidestepped the issue. It would have been easier from there just to go over the Jordan and to go into Jordania, the present Jordania. He could go right, what was always said, he could have gone to Kashmir, to India. That's a theory which is not proved yet. But he could have gone there right away. He had the power to sidestep the issue. But he said, no, I'm not going to sidestep the issue. Something that is very powerful, very courageous, knowing what he would meet, he did not try to evade the situation. So even when he was in Gethsemane, he didn't try to get away. When they were asking him, are you the Jesus? He didn't say, no, I don't know him. Ask the other fellow behind me, perhaps he knows him. And take the occasion to escape or something like that. No, three times he said, yes, I am he. What are you asking more? I am he. Yes, I am. And he really took the position that he is the I am in being, that I am in being, that is going to prove himself as the I am in being. That was so definite now in Jesus' consciousness that he didn't try to evade. Well, when we are in a critical situation, usually it is so that we think, well, this is crucial. Isn't there a way out? And but that was not in Jesus' consciousness. He had a line of reasoning, he had a line of life, he had a way of life, and he went that strict way of life. This is so impressive now in his experience over these few days that are shown before the crucifixion. Then we had here as a first, we should really be a bit more consistent. Let's first read again the underlined epitome about the stone of truth. Principle maintains man eternally intact. So this is the intactness of principle because of truth, because truth is always being aware of itself and claims its own truth and is not fallible, cannot be touched by error, so that the principle of being could use that truth to its utmost. So how did he accomplish that? As a first point of the word, we have said that he did not let him be sidestepped, that he went the way of life, not to sidestep the way of life. This takes courage. This takes enormous lot of courage. And not to evade a situation. I think the biggest courage I ever had in my life, and I wasn't aware of it, it was the time I was excommunicated from the church. I was unknown in the field. I had not yet the field of practice. I only knew one thing, that John Dorley knew the way of life. And without having any financial security, without having any security at all, I only knew one thing, that I shouldn't back out now. That I, in spite, there was no hope for, human hope for my future, that I knew that I could never let John Dorley down. Because I saw that if I would let him down and just say, well, the situation is too big for me, I have to go and get a job and I have to make a living in the field of my training, and I could have made a very good living in my occupation. I just saw I would never survive that. I could never survive that I would have let the idea down. And without having any background whatsoever, neither from an organization, nor from a group, nor from finance, nor from anything, I just felt I can't do that. I knew I would be miserable all my life if I felt I have let down the idea, the new idea that John Dorley saw. And it took an enormous courage, I can tell you, not to go, to say, let's go, not knowing where to go. But being sure that there is a way of life, and that way of life will always pull through. And that way of life has a definite aim and has a definite promise, and that therefore love will fulfill that promise. So you see that here and there we are faced with a situation which demands an enormous lot of courage, not to back out, because one has the opportunities to back out, to sidestep the issue. And if you don't sidestep it and go through it with all the ups and downs that are accompanied by it, we come out at the other end of the tunnel. We will see the light, we'll come out of the tunnel and come into the new light. So Jesus was for me at that time a great example that I could follow, because he didn't back out. The second thing is, which Jesus had to do, he had, in the face of all opposition, to acknowledge his Christ selfhood. We come to the Christ, namely to acknowledge that he said, "I am the King." That was a most dangerous thing to say, because the Jews accused him that he is the King of the Jews, and that was very uncomfortable for Pilate. Pilate was there to see that there is no other king to come up. He was under the command of Caesar in Rome, and his job was to suppress really the Jews and to suppress that they claimed for a king. And so it was a very, very a difficult thing for Jesus to say, "Yes, I am a king." So as to say, "Look here, Jesus, you are not the king. I am the king. I am the King of the Jews."